The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Father, thank you for today. Thank you for the schools that you have here today and the schools that you have across the country here to teach this model of education that involves you and puts you at the center of all that we do. And so I just pray that this time would be productive, God, that we would be able to start some good conversations about how to teach logic well and how to honor you in the process. I pray that you're here with us in this room. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, is that working still? All right, well, my name is Matt Jasinski, as you can see up there. I work at Regent School of Austin in Texas, and I have been at Regents for 8 years. I just finished my eighth year. My first seven were teaching sixth graders in our grammar school, and this past year I taught logic. Does this work? There we go. This last year I taught logic for the first time to our 7th and 8th graders. And kind of throughout the year, I had some conversations with our head of logic, and he's real knowledgeable in philosophy, and that's kind of his wheelhouse. And so we had a lot of conversations this year about how's our logic program doing, how can we do it better, and as I was coming into it kind of fresh, I had a lot of questions about why are we doing things this way? Why is the curriculum that we have the way it is? And so that conversation kind of continued throughout the year. And kind of as we got, you know, around December or so, he was like, you should consider presenting this. I think there's a lot of people out there that have these same questions. And so really more than anything, what this presentation is just kind of the story of my journey through the year and the things I experienced, the questions I asked, and some of the answers I found. And the goal I really have is to start a conversation or to continue maybe, to join in on a conversation that has been going on about how can we teach logic really well to middle school students and can we do it in a way that looks a little bit different? So again, more than anything, that's the goal here, is to be able to get us here together, start sharing some ideas, start a conversation. How can we do this well? Because I think it's really important. And you know, our middle school is called the School of Logic, and you know, for I'm sure that's true at a lot of places, but for students and parents and sometimes teachers to kind of see the logic class as, and it's just kind of that thing over there that we do because we're classical and we call it School of Logic, so we have to do it. Apparently we're not the only ones that have that problem. To me, and maybe this was a little naive, but I was like, that's not good enough. This is called the School of Logic. Like, this should be the class. Not a class, not the thing that we push aside. So, again, really, I'm just going to kind of share with you the journey I went through this year and where I landed on some things, and some of the ideas. And at the end, I have a slide. So I'm going to quote some articles and books and stuff. But at the end, I have a slide with all that stuff on it, so you don't have to try to frantically write down things as we go. But again, that's just kind of the goal. And so I want to start with kind of the history of our logic program at Regents. If I can get this going, maybe. There we go. And so historically what we had done, this is not going to work for me, there we go, is seventh grade in the spring had done informal logic, so the fallacies, and they had used the classical academic press art of argument, so they do the 28 fallacies and those different sorts of reasonings. We do commercials and advertising, you know, that sort of stuff is what we had done. And then in the eighth grade, their fall semester, they came in and did formal logic. So the symbolic, I think it was the Jim Nance stuff that they had, and truth tables and all these things. And so I had walked in the summer before I started teaching it, and I don't have a logic background. it's not something I'd, you know, studied in school. And I started looking through it, and I was like, ooh, this is a lot. And started going through it and started talking to some students who I'd had. So again, I taught sixth grade for 7 years. So I had students all through the high school that had been taking these classes, and, hey, tell me about logic. And they're like, oh, well, I guess it kind of helped in geometry when we did proofs, but, and I was like, oh man, I've got my work cut out for me. And so we kind of looked at that, and I didn't like it. I mean, to be frank, and the fallacies I kind of understood. I was like, okay, cool, this is critical thinking. How do advertisers and different people try to convince you to believe things, and that's good. We can do that. But this formal symbolic stuff, one, I don't see how these two fit together, because that's just not how they were presented in our curriculum. And I really don't see the use in the symbolic stuff. Unless these kids are going to be logicians or software programmers, there's not a whole lot of real practical 14-year-old application to this. And if they are going to be logicians or software programmers, then they'll learn it as they're learning to be a logician or a software programmer, and they don't need to learn it in eighth grade. And so we started looking at some things during the summer, and we ended up landing on the classical academic discovery of deduction, and which is a little more practical, syllogisms, enthymemes, and the just structure of argument. And I really, really liked that. And so we kind of worked through that. And what we ended up deciding is, starting next year, we're only going to do 1 year of logic rather than two semesters. So rather than breaking it up, we're going to do logic all of eighth grade. So we used to kind of split with Bible. So they would do like Bible, logic, Bible over 2 years in the school. And so this year we're going to do seventh grade all year Bible, eighth grade all year logic. So we could give a little more continuity. And so I started in the spring kind of brainstorming and thinking about that. And as I did it, I thought, okay, what are the weaknesses of what we've been doing? Number one, it wasn't connected. That we had fallacies and symbolic logic, and there wasn't a whole lot of continuity between the two. It wasn't real practical. Again, for a 13, 14-year-old kid in 2016 to be walking away doing truth tables was kind of, I don't know how useful this is for you in your next few years of your education. It wasn't interesting. The kids did not like it. They were not interested in it. They weren't engaged. They kind of, again, did it just because we're supposed to do it, which is this, right? It wasn't seen as valuable. I think the students, parents, and to some extent teachers said, why, what is this? Oh, I guess we have to do it because we're classical and it's the school of logic. So, okay, we'll let it go. As long as you don't give my kid below like a B, we're okay. And we'll just move on, right? I think it would have been hard. I couldn't find a student who could really articulate well, hey, how did the logic class benefit you in seventh and eighth grade? They, fallacies, commercial, I can see it in advertising, and okay, that's good. What about how you speak? Can you, and there wasn't a whole lot of that. And I think parents a lot too, that I think it was kind of this, in some ways it was really cool because a lot of the parents didn't know what the logic was, so they wouldn't really question you on it. But at the same time, they didn't know what it was and why it was valuable. And I think that's really important. I just heard a lot of parents say, oh, I don't want my kid to take your class because they just tell me all the fallacies I commit at home and I just can't stand it, and I just want him to be out of there, right? So that was the only thing parents saw, was my kids are now telling me I'm committing fallacies. And then I think to some extent even teachers were like, okay, yeah, we've got that logic teacher over there. They go over there and do that thing. But that doesn't really matter in my science or history or writing class, whatever it is. So, yeah, it's good and cool, but just as long as you tell the kids not to tell me I'm committing a fallacy in my class, we're good, right? And I heard a lot of that the first year too, is, oh, when are you teaching fallacies? Just let us know. And so that was something that I saw as a pretty big issue. If we're going to be the school of logic and we're going to teach this class, our people should know why it's valuable and what we're doing. And then last, is it age appropriate to be teaching for 13, 14-year-old kids truth tables, symbolic logic, you know, some of this stuff? And because I think for a lot of them, it was really hard. I mean, it was for me. I'm 32 years old going into last year, and it was hard because I had never done it before. And so those were some of the questions we came up with, and so we kind of sat down and said, all right, how can we do this better? What how can we make this useful? And I had some conversations with our fortunately, my head of logic used to also be our thesis program leader. So I was like, you know exactly where they're going, how, and you know what you're talking about. How can we make this better to where it would benefit them when they're junior, sophomores, juniors, seniors? And then I had a conversation with our current head of thesis program as well to say, hey, what can we do? And so where we landed was to teach logic less symbolically and more as argumentation. So more of the art of argument. I mean, as the book says, but how do you argue well? And I know that kind of the thing that we had told parents was, well, parents, why are you teaching them to argue? And we said, look, they're going to do it anyway. Let's teach them how to do it well while they're ready to do it. Okay. We had kind of made the analogy of using a laser for surgery, right? These kids are going to get these lasers and try to use them for surgery. We better teach them how to use it before they cut someone up dangerously, or they're too scared to use it, one or the other. And so we kind of landed on this idea of logic as argumentation. And this little table is just some real simple kind of basic ideas of kind of how we got there. I got most of this from an article by Peter Kreeft called Clashing Symbols, which, again, I'll have at the end. I'll have that on there. Where he talks about symbolic logic versus Socratic logic. Symbolic logic is extremely efficient, and so that's one of its huge benefits, right? Because you, especially if you do long, complex things and you're just being able to write letters and symbols, it can be really efficient, kind of as a shorthand. And Socratic or argumentative logic is the longhand, right? So basically, instead of using words, instead of using symbols, you're using words and sentences. And his point, he says on that, is people don't talk in shorthand. People talk in longhand. People don't typically write in shorthand. They write in longhand. And with that, the shorthand, while efficient, can stunt language. It can shrink our language and kind of inhibit it, whereas using the words and the actual sentences can really enhance language. And that's typically how we communicate. We don't communicate, you know, with symbols and in shorthand, typically. It does have a purpose, but when we're talking about, you know, arguing or rhetoric or those sort of things, we want the language enhanced. And the symbolic logic, while not, you know, necessarily perfect, it can be useful, especially early on with the kids in teaching, just the structure of argument. Because a lot of times what I found is when we started talking about structure, they got so caught up in the words. What does this say? Well, that's not true. Okay, it doesn't matter. Don't worry about that right now. We're worried about, I don't agree with that, so it must not be a valid statement. No, just calm down. And so what I did see the value of symbolic was being able to teach basic structure of formal logic and of arguments and being able to say, look, this we're concerned about how this is formed, not what it says. And then later, almost kind of building the foundation and the, you know, the studs of a house, and then later coming on and putting in the drywall and the paint and those sort of things. With the complete sentences, right, of being able to use that. And so that's kind of where, again, this from that article by Kreeft of comparing the two and seeing, yeah, symbolic logic has its uses, but it shouldn't, I don't believe, should be the end-all be-all goal of what we teach middle schoolers. And so we decided let's move more toward an argumentative model, which led us, through the help of our thesis leader, to, first of all, a biblical worldview. So that's where I then started. Okay, so what are we going to do? We're a Christian school. We want to build around biblical worldview. And some of you may already use this for years, but 1 Peter 3:14-16, and it says, even if you suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. And then you get to the key there in the middle. It says, in your heart, honor Christ the Lord, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks for your reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. And so for me, that's the goal, right? Ultimately, that's what we want. We want students who can articulate their faith well and respectfully. So we want students who can, when asked about what they believe, whether it is Christianity or science or history, whatever it is, when they're having conversations in the real world, we want them to be able to articulate it well, kindly. and that can't be overlooked. The idea of being kind and respectful to people you don't agree with. There's a quote I have on my wall by Aristotle that, it was funny because I selected it at the beginning of the year and I was like, oh, I'll throw this on the wall. It sounds good. And, the kids were using it in other classrooms and I was like, well, teachers were like, hey, I think that you have this quote on your wall by Aristotle. I was like, yeah, but it says it's the mark of an educated mind, to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it. And I said, that's what I want. I want you to be able to listen to something respectfully, disagree with it, and still be kind to that person. And so we talked a lot about empathy and those sort of things that are involved with that. But the kindness part can't be overlooked. And I tried very hard this year to hammer that into the kids. You have to be kind. The moment you start yelling and browbeating and insulting, you've lost. You may be right, but you've lost. And we talked about the Pyrrhic victory, and so my Latin teacher was real excited. Oh, you talked about Pyrrhus? That's awesome. But that idea that that can't be overlooked. Ethics and being good is so important. And not just in how you communicate with other people, but how you act in general. It says having a good conscience so that when you are slandered, those who revile your behavior, they don't have anything against you, right? Be above reproach. So this to me became real important, and will be important as we continue to develop. It's really valuable and important for kids to understand you've got to be kind. Because the one thing middle school kids, especially boys, they are looking for the first chance to cut each other's legs out from under them. That's what they're doing. And I know in some way that's how they show each other love. And I get that because I was a 12-year-old boy one time too. And even with my older adult friends, I still do that. I get it. But you've got to know your audience. You've got to understand who you're talking to, which is a big part of what I'm going to talk about here in a little bit too, is audience and context. But kindness cannot be overlooked. That was something that was real important to me. So in terms of our biblical worldview with our curriculum, this is kind of the heart of that. There's obviously a lot of other scripture that can fit alongside of this, of being ready to communicate well and, you know, Jesus himself as a teacher and a lot of other things. But I felt this captured the heart of what we're trying to do pretty well. So we started there and then we moved on and said, okay, we want to teach his argumentation. How are we going to do that? And again, our thesis advisor in my head pointed me to Stephen Toulmin. And I don't know if many of you are familiar with him, but he kind of created this, I think he was in the 60s, kind of created this argumentation mapping idea that is way more inductive and informal than, the structure, formal, symbolic logics out there. And the basic idea of why he did that is he said, look, the other stuff isn't useful to the everyday person. The everyday person doesn't understand that. We need to have something that can be useful in kind of everyday, day-to-day language with people who aren't logicians, and they can talk about argument. And so here's a little picture of his model. And at the end, I have my email address. I'm happy to share this slideshow and all this stuff with any of you. So feel free to email me, and I will give you any stuff. And I'm here all the rest of the conference. I'd be happy to sit down and talk as well. But here's the basic map, and I'm going to come out from behind here real quick and just try to be loud. On the top left, you have what's called grounds or evidence. There we go. So your grounds and evidence is the second one. That's your data and examples that support what you're trying to argue, which is your claim. Right? So your claim is your thesis statement. Right? Star Wars is the greatest movie ever. Right? Whatever it is. Cats are better than dogs. Okay? That's my claim. So that's the thesis, the thing I'm trying to prove, I'm trying to argue. And then you have these grounds, reasons, or evidence. Those are your kind of concrete details or examples as to why Star Wars is such a great movie, or what makes a great movie, or those sort of things. And then the kind of the next piece is what's here called warrant, and then also backing, which is just kind of a secondary part of warrant, that is kind of the mental leap that we all make from Star Wars has really, really cool action and special effects, therefore it's the greatest movie ever. And that mental leap we make is that great movies have good special effects and action, right? We don't necessarily have to state that, but we kind of leap there anyway in that argument. And so that's kind of what your warrant and backing are. Your rebuttal is then your counter argument, right? So it's your antithesis. Why would people say, okay, yeah, that's true, but, you know, what about the love scenes and the romance? Those have to be in a good movie too, and Star Wars doesn't have that, right? Or whatever it may be. And so the rebuttal is again, just kind of, or maybe the exception of, yeah, that's true all these times except here. And then that rebuttal then affects what is called your qualifier. So Star Wars is definitely the greatest movie ever. Star Wars is mostly the greatest movie ever. Star Wars is kind of the greatest movie ever, right? So the qualifier can lessen your claim. It can kind of soften your claim depending on your evidence and your grounds and those sort of things, and maybe the rebuttal, right? So I say Star Wars is the greatest movie ever, and someone says, yeah, but there's no romance. Okay, well, Star Wars is the greatest movie ever for people who don't like romance, right? So now I've qualified my statement, and I've softened my claim in response to the rebuttal. And so this is kind of the model that we're using in our thesis and rhetoric classes to kind of say, hey, kids, this is how we want you to build the arguments. And so we were like, well, why don't we just teach them this starting in middle school? This is the structure of a good argument. That's what logic's supposed to be. And really what we're focusing on is going to be the evidence, the warrant, and the claim. Qualifiers, rebuttals, backing, we're not real concerned about that. We want kids to be able to say, I believe A because of B and C. If they can do that, leaving eighth grade, and know what they're doing, I feel like that'd be pretty successful and be in a pretty good place and do it well without messing it up, which we'll talk about a little bit too. But this is the basic Toulmin model. And again, he created this, again, I think it was in the 60s, as just a form of argumentation. It's a lot more informal and a lot more inductive. It's not as, you know, we're not dealing with certainties. We're dealing with probabilities and generalizations. But this is where we landed. We said, let's make this kind of the heart of what we're doing for all argumentation, logic, rhetoric, whatever it is. And I'll talk about this a little bit at the end, but I think it's pretty easy to see. You could use this in writing. You could use this in science. You could use this in history. You could use this in Bible. There's a lot of it. This allows for, I think, great integration across the board. And so one of my goals this year, just teaching eighth graders, is to try to find a way to touch one part of each subject using this or our argumentation. So, okay, you guys are talking about World War II. Let's look at, you know, somebody's claim that they made about Nazi Germany and see how did they build their claim. Or you just did a science experiment. What was your outcome? Okay, well, that's your claim, right? Your conclusion is your claim. What was the evidence you did in the experiment that led you to that claim? Something along those lines to help lead to some more integration and eventually have all of our teachers using this language as they're having our... So then the school of logic becomes all teachers using logic in their classes, and it really does become integrated, and it's not these kind of siloed off or exiled class while everybody else is integrated, and it's like, hey, logic guy, and then everybody else is over here. So that's kind of our hope moving forward. And so then we'll kind of get into that with the kids, and then we will do still some deductive and formal, primarily focusing on the structure of an argument. How is an argument structured? Okay, how is an argument structured well? How is it structured poorly? How can it fall apart? And in that, using syllogisms and enthymemes as kind of the primary tool. And the enthymeme is actually fits with the Toulmin model really well because, you know, the enthymeme being, you know, hey, you have your two premises and your conclusion, but with an enthymeme, you're removing one of those. Well, that's kind of what Toulmin does, right? It uses your premise and your conclusion, and that warrant sort of serves as that mental leap. that's there. So it can kind of line up fairly well. But again, the enthymeme being key, because a lot of times, one, people don't speak in syllogisms, which is one of the first things students always point out. Nobody talks this way. You're right. They don't. You're absolutely correct. But we can still take what they say and kind of mold it to this form and go from there. But enthymemes are a lot more common, I think, in everyday language inferring and letting that mental leap just kind of be unstated as we move forward. And then from there, talk about validity. How are these syllogisms and enthymemes, when are they valid, when are they invalid, how can they be formed correctly or incorrectly? And again, this is where the symbolic part can be helpful, is getting them to understand. Because I think the toughest battle I had this year was, just because you don't agree with it doesn't mean it's invalid. Or just because you agree with it doesn't mean it's valid. Okay, you've got to understand, when we're talking about truth and validity, they're not the same thing. And so symbols, I think, I found were helpful in that, of saying, don't worry about words, don't worry about anything, just worry about what does it look like and how is it formulated. And so validity, again, the symbols can be helpful there. And then we get into the propositional stuff a little bit. I think this can be really useful. But modus ponens, modus tollens, hypotheticals, dilemma, and then kind of the related fallacies with those. So denying the antecedent, affirming the consequent, false dilemma, some of those things. So they can see some of those if-then statements and either-or statements and how those can fall apart. And again, the symbolic can be somewhat helpful there. I actually think words are easier to teach some of this propositional stuff with. That was just what I kind of found this year. Because when I told them, if A, then B, A, therefore B, they were like, yeah, okay. I said, okay, look, on your Xbox, if you pull the right trigger, the gun shoots. You pulled the right trigger, therefore the gun shoots. They're like, yeah, we totally get that. I said, well, that's how your whole video game system works, is all this stuff. And they're like, really? Yes, it does. It's amazing. It's a lot of it, but it's amazing. And then they got really interested and wanted to talk about Call of Duty and stuff. But we had to move on. But I do think words and examples in those cases can be helpful. So that's kind of going to be our approach to deductive and formal. And I think we're going to try doing that first. Historically, we had done the informal and then the formal. But as I kind of thought through it, and I'll talk about this in a minute, I think the informal stuff is very abstract, whereas the formal is a lot more concrete. And so if we're talking about teaching 13-year-olds, 12, 13-year-olds in 7th grade, abstract, informal logic, I don't know that they're ready for that. And I saw that a lot, because as I would teach them these fallacies, it was black and white to them. They were like, it's either is or it isn't. And anytime I hear someone say a bad thing about somebody, it's an ad hominem automatically. You can't tell me it's not, right? And so I started to see, you know what, this is pretty abstract, but if we can do a more concrete, it's either valid or it's not, there's no gray, I think developmentally, that's a little more appropriate. And so we're going to start with deductive this year. We're going to do some tool mean and then go to deductive and then move into the inductive or informal. And this is where I really had, I think I got excited and have learned more about this than anything. But what I saw was, I saw kids using fallacies irresponsibly as a gotcha technique. It was their opportunity to tell someone older than them and in their authority, hey, I gotcha, you're wrong, that's a fallacy. And they weren't applying them correctly. And they didn't understand that, you know, sometimes an appeal to emotion is appropriate. It's not always a fallacy. And sometimes appealing to the old ways or the new thing is appropriate. It's not a fallacy. You've got to be able to discern when it is and when it isn't. And so I started kind of wrestling through that, and I don't even remember how I came across it, but I came across an article by a woman named Anne-Marie Womack. She's a rhetoric professor at Tulane. So she's secular. She's certainly not classical Christian. But it was fantastic. I read through it, and I was like, oh, yes, this is everything I've been thinking. And again, the article is called From Logic to Rhetoric. And what she puts forward is the current, she talks about the current approach to teaching fallacies. And she does a whole lot more research and data in there. Google it, you can find it real easily. It'll be the first thing you find on Google if you just Google From Logic to Rhetoric, Anne Marie Womack. It'll be the first hit. But she has charts and stuff in there where she went through multiple texts of how are they teaching fallacies and they're doing it this way. And it's really good. But she said what she saw in the current approach is that it's being taught as very black and white, which I agreed with. I was like, yeah, absolutely. I see that. It's used as a gotcha technique, and it's being used a lot of times, she said, in you know, not in middle school or high school or even college, but beyond that, as a way to shut people down. Because a lot of times you throw, hey, that's a red herring, or that's straw man. A lot of people don't know what you're talking about. And so if they're less educated than you, then they just kind of, you know, they'll just kind of skirt aside and say, oh, well, I'm not going to argue back with that because I don't know what they're talking about. And so they were using him as a way, kind of disrespectfully, to shut people down. And that they were being applied uncritically because, and this is the thing I hadn't thought about before, but I really liked. She'll put this in her kind of revised approach. But they're not black and white. They're gray. Their fallacies aren't simply, oh, that's either ad hominem or it's not. Well, it kind of depends. It depends on what you're saying, the background, who you're talking to. There's a lot of pieces to it. This was the thing that was interesting. Fallacies are actually improperly applied persuasive techniques. So it's when I'm using a good technique improperly. And when I call something a fallacy, I'm actually making an argument myself. So if I say that's an ad hominem or that's a straw man, I need to be able to defend that. I'm making a claim. I need evidence. I need data. I need warrant. I need to be able to say why. Why in this situation is the use of that word or that phrase or whatever straw man or you know, red herring or whatever. I think the important thing is for students to understand, yes, we want to know what the fallacies are. We want to be able to recognize them. But you can't just start throwing words out there at people, saying this is a fallacy, that's a fallacy. When you do that, really what you're doing is you're making a counter argument. And you need to be able to make that argument, not just give it a name and walk away. But to be able to defend it and defend what you're saying. So they and the other thing is the context matters. And she talked she talks about audience a lot. And it was kind of interesting. Did any of y'all see the OJ Made in America documentary on ESPN recently? It's fantastic. If you haven't seen it, it's phenomenal. But I noticed this. It was interesting in Johnny Cochran's closing remarks. To keep it short, he basically ends up comparing Mark Furman to Hitler. And it was funny because I was like, really? Are you serious, dude? That is ridiculous. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, false analogy. You're wrong. But as they were interviewing people, there were people who were like, yeah, right on. You're right. That's a great analogy. And so I was like, you know what? I guess audience does kind of matter. Because depending on who he was speaking to and who was listening to him, that was a good analogy. Or not. Again, depending on who it was. And so that's just one example of how context is important. Who you're speaking to, you can say the exact same words to two different audiences, and one time it's a fallacy and one time it's not. And so she hits on that pretty heavily, that audience and context are important with fallacies. And so that was kind of... that was refreshing for me to hear, and it was really life-giving because I was feeling that tension of these are not black and white, guys. And I knew it within myself, but I wasn't confident or know it enough to be able to say, hey, here's exactly how it should be. But to get this kind of affirmation and be able to say, okay, no, this is right. It is the case that they're not so black and white all the time was real important and helpful to me. So, the other thing that she talks about is teaching them on a sliding scale. I'm going to show you an example of that in just a minute. But she pairs every fallacy with a persuasive technique in a Venn diagram, and that's coming up on one of these next slides, and not as these mathematical formula of true or false, it is a fallacy, it isn't a fallacy, equal or unequal, right? And so here's an example of those Venn diagrams. And if you, again, if you Google her stuff, she's got another, she's got a website, and she has like 30 of these different Venn diagrams, but this was just a small sample. But you can see valid generalization versus a hasty generalization. It can, a lot of times it can be valid. Sometimes it can be hasty. Sometimes it can kind of be, we're not sure. Or useful common values versus mob appeal, ad hoc, right? Which is, you know, a big one. But sometimes, yeah, we do have things in common, so it's important to say, hey, everybody kind of feels this way. And so you can see, again, there's a lot of those on there, but that's how she teaches them. It's kind of a sliding scale of gray that it can be extremely valid or it can be an extreme fallacy, but a lot of times it may fall in the middle somewhere. And then how do we determine if it's good or bad? Well, a lot of that has to do with context and audience. So I really liked the way this was paired. And it made sense to me, and I thought it would be a lot more helpful for the students. So this year moving forward, that's how we're going to go about kind of presenting fallacies to the kids, is we're going to talk about, hey, here's a valid, very good persuasive technique or logical technique or whatever we want to call it, but here's how it can go wrong. Here's how you can use it incorrectly or improperly. And then so that was kind of the conclusions we reached on deductive and inductive, which then gets to the application, right? And again, a lot of this that I'm putting up here, I haven't put into practice yet, coming out of this kind of first year and some of this journey. So this is the part where I would really, the idea sharing and the conversation, I think, can really gain some traction and hopefully we can come up with some great stuff, because I know we have some wonderful minds out there that can really help work with this. But these were just some general ideas. But number one, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to teach and practice tool mean, right? So I actually did this with the kids. But we have them make simple, small, simple arguments using just the claim, the grounds, and the warrant. And we did this with Star Wars. So I wrote on the board, I said, Star Wars is the greatest movie ever. And I said, okay, you need to agree or disagree and give me two reasons why. Well, are you talking about one movie or the whole series? Well, I kind of like it, but no, stop. Yes or no. You have to pick a side. Well, no, stop, right? Just pick a side and tell me, yes, it's the greatest movie ever, or no, it's not. Well, is it the whole series? I don't care. You decide. This is your argument. And so we had some fun with that and went through it. But just doing something like that to get them started and saying, you know, cats are better than dogs. Agree or disagree. Oh, but I like lizards. No, we're not talking about lizards. We're talking about cats and dogs here. You know, let's keep this simple. But force them into simple, silly arguments that they have to formulate and say, here's what I believe, cats are better than dogs, and here's two reasons why that support it. Now, obviously, those aren't going to necessarily be the most scientific, data-driven evidence reasons, and that's fine, because a lot of times our arguments aren't driven by those things. They are opinionated, and there is a level of uncertainty to what we're saying. But have fun with it. We had a blast with that one. It was a lot of fun. So and then using that tool mean language, the big thing that I want to do at the beginning, and again, a lot of this has to do with our high school goals and objectives as well, is introduce them to the language of tool mean so that they know it, they're using it, and they hear it. And when you say, hey, what's your claim? They know what you're talking about. What are your grounds, your warrant? They're familiar with those terms moving into high school, so our rhetoric teachers aren't having to reintroduce them to those things. And then from there, we'll go into the formal logic and the structure. Hey, syllogisms, use some symbols to kind of teach them formal structure of things. And doing that first because I think it's more concrete and in some ways easier to understand because it is black and white. The other way I thought about it is, well, if formal is your, you know, your foundation and your beams in your house, why wouldn't you do that first? Why wouldn't you build the structure of something first before you start throwing on the pretty stuff, which is typically the more informal. And I know that's not a perfect analogy, but this that same idea. And then so using the symbolic to teach the structure, and then kind of add sentences to that as you go and get them to apply that. Syllogisms, enthymemes, validity, that stuff that we talked about a little bit earlier. And what we have used, again, is the discovery of deduction in my classical academic press. I'm sure they don't mind me plugging them a little bit. But we found it to be really, really useful. It's pretty practical if you've used Art of Argument. It's a lot of the same stuff. They have the little conversations at the beginning of each chapter that between Nate and Socrates or whatever, and the kids think they're kind of corny, but I think they really help because Nate's asking a lot of the same questions the kids are asking. I remember opening the book when we got a sample of it, and I was like, oh, let's see how this book is. And the first thing I saw was Nate say, nobody talks in syllogisms. And I was like, oh, this is a great book. We're going to buy it. But they do. They add some, you know, they have some real good kind of just kind of ancillary activities that support some of the stuff that's not just dry do a syllogism. It's, hey, read this Sherlock Holmes story and what are the, you know, pick apart Holmes' two arguments in this part, which the kids love, and it's a lot of fun. So that's what we're going to use there. And then we're going to go to the informal and the fallacies. We're going to try to teach them inductively. That's the other thing that Anne-Marie Womack talks about is teaching the kid, hey, here's a good technique. How could this go wrong? Or, hey, here's a bunch of sentences. There's something wrong with them. They all have a mistake in common. Can you tell me what it is? Oh, hey, they're all using they all have to do with emotion and not correctly. Good. Okay, and kind of let them sort of discover and uncover some of that on their own. Rather than saying, here's what appeal to emotion is, and here's bad examples of it, ABC, you know, appeal to fear, you know, those sort of things. And let them kind of discover some of that on their own. And one of the things I found really useful with that was, believe it or not, political debates and advertisements. I'd show them, you know, there was I think it was Ted Cruz and Donald Trump were going at it for a couple minutes. And I showed them the video, and they were laughing, and it was funny. And I said, all right, what's wrong? And every hand shot up, and they were like, he did this, and they didn't say anything. And I was like, yeah, exactly. They talked for 4 minutes and said nothing. It was amazing. But they saw it immediately. And I think sometimes, I know I don't give the kids enough credit for how smart they are before I teach them anything. They pick up on this stuff. They see it, and so giving them an opportunity to call it out, I think they really like that. Saying, oh, look, these adults made a mistake. It's really funny. And letting them see that. And so we'll do some of that. And obviously you guide them along the way and into the correct place. But letting them discover some of that on their own. And then some of the activities. And these are just, again, things we're going to try. And I've done some this past year. We did commercials this year, which was a lot of fun. I made them use fallacies in a commercial. Okay, you have to make a commercial. I don't care what the product is. But you have to use one of these five fallacies in your commercial. But don't make it too obvious, right? Because commercials don't do that. You want to make it kind of subtle. And I had them do storyboards of their commercials. So, hey, you have six frames. You have to kind of draw it out. Have them give them speeches. Humor. I found an article called Syllogisms in Seinfeld that was actually really good. It talked about how equivocation and some of the logical fallacies are the basis for all of our humor. And the kids ate that up. I mean, as much as they love comedy and humor and stuff and cartoon strips, and we did some Garfield and some other things that was a lot of fun. My kind of back pocket go-to was Sherlock Holmes. I love Sherlock Holmes, and so any chance to just sit down and read Sherlock Holmes, it's like, hey, yeah, let's do this. He's deductive. This certainly applies to what we're doing somehow. And I even started showing him some of the clips of the BBC Sherlock series, which is Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. It's fantastic. And they loved it. They, can we watch Sherlock? No, we're not watching Sherlock today. Oh, please, we have finals tomorrow. No, but we can just watch Sherlock. It'll review us. No, guys, just calm down. And so, you know, they got all into it, and a lot of them, I think, went home and watched the series. And they, oh, have you seen? Yes, I've seen all the episodes. That's why I'm showing it to you. But they're like, oh, have you seen? Yeah, yeah. So it was a lot of fun. But I use Sherlock Holmes a lot. And again, the discovery of deduction has a lot of the just picks out a lot of the stories for you and says, hey, use these stories and parts. And then, but just anything you can do to just let them have fun with it and be creative. And the thing we're going to do this year that's going to be new is we're creating a, I can't use the T word, thesis, because it's not that, right? But we're creating a capstone project for our School of Logic where all eighth graders, at the end of the year, instead of taking a final, are going to participate in a debate tournament. Which, hopefully, theoretically, is their application of everything they've learned, of how to argue well, how to structure an argument, how to communicate, how to avoid a fallacy, how to think on your feet, and sort of those things. And we're still kind of in the process of figuring out exactly what that's going to look like. But the goal is to have that be at the end of the year. We do it in our big, we have a, we call it the hearth room in our school, where our School of Logic, where there's just a big, big open room, and we have the teams debate, and we can invite parents and just have it be a big fun thing that the kids do at the end of eighth grade every year as a, hey, I'm graduating from the School of Logic, and I actually learned something about logic, and here I am applying it now. Of it being the goal, so that when they walk away, they can actually say, hey, yeah, I remember. We did learn something. Remember those debates we did? That was awesome. And then we'll have a winner every year, and we'll probably make a plaque and put the winner's names on it, and we'll probably do them team style, because 90-something kids is too many to have one individual tournament with. But that's where we're going to head it all toward. And so I like that as a teacher, because it gives me an aiming point of saying, hey, here's where they're going, and then we can kind of work backwards using all the rest of this that we came across. So that's where we're headed. So again, here are, if it will pop up, there we go, the books and articles. I'll leave those up there for a little bit if you want to copy any of them down. We're actually going to be using, instead of the Art of Argument for our informal, we're going to use, again, it's Class Clock Dynamic Press. It's called the Argument Builder. It's really good. It's they aim it for, I think, kind of like freshman rhetoric students. But what it does is it can be however long you want it to be, but they sell it as kind of a 9-week course where they build an argument, and it walks you through here are four or five different ways you can build an argument. And then with that, as they're going through, hey, here's one way you can build an argument, they then say, here are the fallacies related to those. And then here's how you can build an argument. Here's fallacies related to those. And so it does a really good job of what we're trying to do, which is say, hey, we're teaching you how to argue well, but here's how it can go wrong. And they tie them up really well together. And so I don't know. It's a good text. Throughout the book itself, they actually have the kids using the same argument. I think it's like dress code or something like that. That they use their same stance on that argument, but they apply the different techniques to it throughout the book to say, oh, okay, let's try an emotional appeal to this. Let's try a statistical appeal. Let's try, you know, so different things. And so by the end, the kids have then created four or five pieces of grounds or evidence to support their claim, essentially. And so we really like it. And it has a little thing in the back about debate and different things. But then they also, Classical Academic, has just published a book called Everyday Debate, which we're piloting. We're starting a debate elective this year that I'm going to teach, and we're going to use that text for the debate elective, which is different than the logic class. But that book is really good as well. So we even actually for a while kind of considered using it in our logic class because it does some of the similar stuff. It talks about how to persuade and how to build arguments and speak, and then kind of some of the fallacies that can go with it. Argument Builder kind of fit a little bit more of what we were trying to do in logic. than the debate book. But and then we'll use the art argument to supplement as needed if we need a little more material on some of the fallacies, or we want to add one that's not in Argument Builder. But they're really good books. And so I would again, I'm sure they don't mind me plugging them, but take a look at them. They do some good stuff with those. Those are the two articles I talked about earlier, Clashing Symbols, and then From Logic to Rhetoric, Anne-Marie Womack. I will tell you, with Womack, she's a secular professor, so some of her material on her website has more mature content for college-age students, so I wouldn't use it in your class, but for you to read on your own, I think could be useful. But this article here was by far the most useful for me. It really hit home. Uses of Argument by Stephen Toulmin. It's really heady, and it's pretty intense. But it goes through the his model. I think it's in chapter 3 that he goes through his model. And then there's another book. I can't remember the book by him that is supposed to be a simpler version. But I have a really good succinct article on the Toulmin model. If you want it, email me, and I'll be happy to email it to you to back. It's real succinct, simple, and it tells you exactly what it is. Socratic Logic by Peter Kreeft is a textbook, and it's pretty heavy too, but it's got some good stuff in there about Socratic Logic. And then Universe Next Door by James Sire. I put that up there because one of the things we do want to make sure the kids understand is worldview as well. One of the things that's really hard for them to get sometimes, you cannot argue constructively with a person with whom you have no agreement. You've got to have something you agree on. There's got to be some place where you agree on something common to then build in an argument. If you don't agree on anything at all, it's going to be really, really difficult. And so we talk a little bit about worldview. This book is fantastic as a worldview catalog. It's an easy read. It's real. You can engage with it really easily, but it's really, really good. So if you're looking for something good on worldview and how you can kind of do that with your kids, that's a great one. And then in terms, I forgot to put it on here, but in terms of being good and being a good man arguing, Back to Virtue by Kreeft is fantastic. Back to Virtue by Peter Kreeft is a wonderful, wonderful text that just talks about ethics and virtue and what it means to be good. So that is all I have. I'll close. Here's my email and, of course, my family. You got to always have a picture of your family, right? That's my wife, Lauren, my daughter, who is 6, Avery, and then Beckett will be 4 in August. That's my son, Beckett, so out on our front porch. But there's my email address, and I'm happy to answer any questions now as well. And, again, I'll be here throughout the conference if anybody wants to chat. So thank you. You might have any questions or comments or ideas, or yes, ma'am.